I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Busing as a way to end racial segregation in public schools became a campaign issue last week at the Thursday night presidential debate. That's when Senator Kamala Harris, who was bused when she went to school in Berkeley, California, accused former Vice President Joe Biden of opposing busing in Delaware when he was a senator back in the 1970s. Let's listen.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a
so
local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA.
This testy exchange got us thinking about Biden and the use of busing a generation ago to desegregate schools after Brown versus the Board of Education declared in 1954 that separate was not equal. After ruling in the 1970s, Wilmington, Delaware, and the surrounding counties united in a kind of super district, with students from the city and the suburbs bused to achieve more racially balanced schools. Busing was a contentious topic in a number of communities back then. It's largely been abandoned in favor of things like choice and community schools. Well, today on Radio Times, the lessons of desegregation busing. And joining us from the studios of Northwestern University is Brett Gadsden. He's a professor of history at Northwestern University, author of Between North and South, Delaware, Desegregation, and the Myth of American Sectionalism. In fact, he grew up in Wilmington and was bused from the suburbs to a downtown school starting in fourth grade. Brett Gadsden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Rand Quinn. He's associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the forthcoming book, Class Action, Desegregation and Diversity in San Francisco Schools. Rand Quinn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
Me as well. And Brett, let me begin with you and begin with you as a fourth grader getting bused into a school in Wilmington, Delaware. What was that experience like for you?
I think it wasn't a very exceptional experience at all, if in my memory of it. I one day went to a school that was very near my home in North Wilmington, in the suburbs right north of the city. And I walked for a couple years to school, and then the next year I got on a bus and went downtown to George Gray School. Important side note, I'm African American. And
right.
So, you know, for the first couple years of my schooling, I was one of a very few African Americans in the Wilmington suburbs who attended public schools. When I was bused subsequently down to George Gray School, I was suddenly surrounded by a mixed classroom. I had lots of African American classmates and an African American student. My family supported it. It, you know, as far as I was concerned, as a young, very young person, it went off without a hitch.
And did you attend largely black schools or, I guess, Wilmington schools until high school graduation?
Well, we moved away from Wilmington on a number of occasions. But no, I only went to city schools through sixth grade. And then I went to George Gray and then Martin Luther King Jr. And then we were assigned to suburban junior high and high schools.
Was there, and you were a young person, so you know, I realize you weren't an expert in this, but did you notice as a student that there were differences between the suburban school that you attended and the school in downtown Wilmington?
I don't remember much difference. I mean, I don't remember conflict between students, you know, not overtly. I do remember a couple of moments at George Gray when we were evacuated because someone had phoned in death threats to the school. But I think largely, I think within the classroom, within schools, things unfolded, at least from my kind of limited perspective at the time, largely without tension or drama. Now, that I don't mean to kind of generalize my experience to the to the rest of my classmates. I know that there were still the problems of kind of racial segregation mm-hmm. within schools, racial tracking of students, but those particular problems didn't afflict me in the same way.
I'm thinking of what happened in Boston when they tried to desegregate schools, and there was a lot of violence and riots. Anything similar to that in Wilmington that you were aware of?
In my personal experience and in my research, I didn't find the same kind of violent, virulent, popular backlash to the busing programs of the 1970s in Wilmington, Delaware. Indeed, I think public officials went to great lengths to avoid another Boston in the Wilmington metropolitan area.
And I guess largely successful.
Yes. Indeed, I think that, in thinking about the busing, the Wilmington busing remedy, it actually produced really significant levels of school desegregation in the metropolitan area schools until the late 20th century. And I think a lot of people, black and white, came to understand them as a great success. But there were still questions and concerns, I think, about the inequitable implementation of the busing remedies, that, African-American students were expected to travel more years of their school careers than white students, and they oftentimes had to travel greater distances. But I think that so it wasn't, it wasn't without its problems, but I think that many people in the metropolitan area had great pride in the levels of desegregation that I achieved by the, through the 1990s.
Ryan Quinn, let me get you in on the conversation. You have looked at busing as it was implemented across the country in San Francisco. How different was that, or is that?
There are a lot of similarities in San Francisco as we see in other communities in the West, especially in the North. And there was a lot of resistance in the 60s and 70s, almost immediately after the Brown decision went down, black activists began pushing the school district to desegregate. And the district avoided the issue, said, we don't know if our districts are segregated. We haven't done a racial census of the schools, and that occupied several years of effort. And so it wasn't really until 1971, along with sort of these busing plans that were implemented throughout the country, that San Francisco began a desegregation plan that entailed busing. And
a more racially and perhaps ethnically diverse community we're talking about here.
San Francisco has, for generations, has had sizable communities of Asian American and Latinx students. And so even though the lawsuit in San Francisco was from the NAACP on behalf of black students against the school district, the desegregation plan naturally had to entail Asian American and Latino students. And this was less of a problem in the early 1970s, and it became increasingly more of a problem to the point where the district's definition of desegregation and integration had to change, and the actual student assignment system had to be modified in order to sort of better accommodate the racial demography of the city.
Let me go back to, I guess, Brown versus the Board of Education saying essentially that separate was not equal. So the goal was, and I'll put this to you, Brett, the goal was to integrate schools and by that improve education for all students. Was that the kind of essential thinking behind desegregation busing?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, if many of your viewers will remember that Brown was a bundle of five cases, and one of the cases was a Delaware school segregation case. And so the kind of evidence of racial segregation and constitutional violations in Delaware became instrumental in the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. In the early 1970s, school desegregation proponents filed suit against the state, charging that the segregation in the city schools and the suburb schools was a function of a kind of myriad discriminatory policies in education and housing policy, and the courts proved sympathetic. And so, in the difference between the the Brown decision of 54 and the decisions that we see coming down in the early 1970s, the Supreme Court strikes a blow against Jim Crow in 54. In 1970s, the courts begin to kind of pivot and think more, take a more expansive view of constitutional violations, taking into account, like they did in the Wilmington case, education policy and housing policy.
And Delaware, I grew up in Delaware as well. Before you, Brett, I actually lived in Middletown, Delaware in the 1950s, which had a black high school and a white high school. So it was a clearly segregated education system. So Delaware is an interesting place to talk about because it kind of straddles the North and the South.
Well, you know, when I came across the, you know, Delaware and the school segregation and desegregation when I was searching for a dissertation topic many years ago, and I was astounded to discover that Delaware was a Jim Crow state, especially as far as public education was concerned. Segregated schools were written into the Delaware Constitution. And that was a really kind of striking fact for me. I mean, I grew up in Wilmington. My cultural reference point was Philadelphia. I mean, I was an Eagles fan, a Sixers fan, a
Phillies. You're giving a lot away here, Brett.
Cheesesteaks. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think of myself as a Southerner in any way, shape, or form. And over the course of my research, I began to understand the kind of complex political character of the state, the ways in which there was this kind of – this Wilmington, this northern community or northern area that many people understood to be more related to South Jersey and Philadelphia, and then kind of below the canal – where people kind of most associated with the kind of political culture and the political economy of the Delmarva Peninsula.
And much more rural, much more agricultural.
Exactly.
As you say, when you cross that bridge into Georgetown, I guess, and into southern Delaware, it certainly was a very different place back then.
Yeah, and I didn't quite understand that growing up. We went to Rehoboth Beach on a number of occasions, and we made a beeline right down the highway to the beach. We didn't stop, in between. So I was grateful for the opportunity to do this research because I got to understand the kind of rich kind of political, cultural history of my home state. And then, I think it was because of that kind of dual character, right, that many people understand about the state that it provided this rich site for research.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the lessons of desegregation busing, something that came up last week between Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris. We played a clip from that. Brett Gadsden joining us from the studios of Northwestern University, professor of history at Northwestern, author of a book called Between North and South about Delaware and desegregation. Rand Quinn with us as well, associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. He's got a forthcoming book called Class Action, Desegregation and Diversity in San Francisco Schools. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about the history of busing and school desegregation in Delaware around the country, whether it was an effective means of integrating schools, providing an equal education to all students. In many ways, it has gone away, but in certain districts, it has come back as well or is coming back. Let me play another clip, and this goes back to a press conference that Senator Joe Biden had June 28th, 1977. Here he is responding to a reporter's question asking how he responds to people who say, quote, that you have set back the movement of desegregation in schools by opposing mandatory busing.
I was a defense lawyer. I handled civil rights cases. I sat in on Route 40. I mean, I'm not from the other side of this. And I happen to think that the one way to ensure that you set the civil rights movement in America further back is to continue to push busing because it's a bankrupt policy.
Rand, let me give you a chance to respond to that. And he's taking a very particular and perhaps even narrow position on busing. But what was he saying back then?
Well, he's favoring local control. And this was an argument that many leaders in the North and in the West adopted, everywhere actually adopted. Schools are a local institution. They should be locally determined. Let us figure out the way to do this. And that's contrary to what the Supreme Court ruled. Again, as we talked about earlier, the court determined that separate cannot be equal, and education was a right that must be made available to all on equal terms. And so schools that were segregated, whether they were segregated by law or segregated in fact, had to desegregate, regardless of what any kind of local intentions were.
Brett, let me get – this is another quote also going back to 1975. This is Joe Biden. He says, in cases where a school system has racially segregated by gerrymandering district lines or by other legalistic means, that he would support desegregation busing under those circumstances. But in where people sort of end up living where they live for no apparent reason of segregation, that he opposed busing when it came to that. Can you speak to that?
I'd actually not heard that particular quotation, but it's rather odd kind of admission, because the racial segregation that was evident in the Wilmington metropolitan area in the 1970s, the courts determined was a function of education and housing policy. That, you know, the city or that the state had kind of had delineated the Wilmington School District as a predominantly African, a black school district. There was a record of discrimination in the placement of public housing that concentrated black and particularly working class and poor people in the Wilmington proper, that, you know, that housing authorities, you know, purposefully refused to place public housing in the surrounding suburbs. There was evidence that racial covenants were being enforced long after the courts had determined that they were unconstitutional. There was evidence of racial steering in housing policies. So I think one of the problems that, you know, I have when the vice president kind of talks about, he's trying to kind of parse, right?
Yes.
He's expressing his support for the principles embedded in Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965, equal rights and equal opportunity. And I think he's, in some ways, he's really sincere, and his public record kind of plays out. But on the other hand, I think, you know, he got himself in trouble with Senator Harris, and I think with others, in the extent to which in his kind of opposition to federal intervention in the affairs, like Rand recalled, in the affairs of local communities and how they manage their school districts, I think he begins to run afoul with liberals and progressives today, to the extent to which in the articulation of that argument, we begin to see kind of echoes of the kind of unreconstructed Southerners of yore, because they were fervently opposed to the intervention of the federal government in the affairs of states and local communities in their opposition to school segregation, you know, dating back to the 40s and 50s.
I mean, it becomes sort of weirdly then a states' rights issue. I'm looking at you, Rand. And Biden did call busing a bankrupt policy. He also said, I'm a civil rights activist. And part of the question is, can you oppose busing and call yourself a civil rights activist?
Well, in many cities, it's very difficult to desegregate schools without busing. And this is due to the neighborhood segregation that many cities have. That's a root, at its root is residential housing discrimination and the like. And so, you know, we often think about education as a institution in and of itself, but it's hard to think about reform, desegregation and similar reforms without thinking about housing policy, transit policy, economic development. And so in many cities, it's impossible to desegregate without some kind of movement of kids to other neighborhoods, just due to the severe residential segregation that we see.
Well, look at Philadelphia. I mean, you and I were talking about this before we go in the air. Apparently, students of color attend the most racially isolated schools in the country, and largely, I think, because of zip code, right?
That's right. And what we see in Philadelphia is what we see in Oakland and San Francisco and elsewhere. it's a problem, and it's a problem that can't be addressed solely by school reform or education reform. It has to entail housing policy and other institutions at a local level to really get at the root of it.
Let me quote Joe Biden again, and Brett, I'll go back to you. And again, this goes back to the 1970s, but part of what he says in this quote here is, and this is about busing, he says, what it says is, in order for your child with curly black hair, brown eyes, and dark skin to be able to learn anything, he needs to sit next to my blonde-haired, blue-eyed son. And then Biden says, that is racist. Who the hell do we think we are that the only way a black man or woman can learn is if they rub shoulders with my white child? And I've heard that quote before, but I'm curious how you respond to that, what you hear in that quote.
Well, I just think it missed the point. Wherever black students, African-American students, and students of color have been racially segregated or separated, whatever you want to call it, across time and space, whether it's in Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia in the 1940s, or Philadelphia, Rand would know this better, Los Angeles, San Francisco today, we see kind of separate and unequal outcomes in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. and so, you know, I don't quite understand that argument. It seems kind of base and crass, but again, it's kind of dependent upon a kind of willed amnesia about how racial segregation works in America. And where racial segregation is in operation, it serves systematically to diminish the political, economic, and kind of social standing of people of color. And that's a fact that we just simply cannot ignore.
Rand, I know you want to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, just to add, I mean, I think that quote by Biden is appalling. And really what's taking place here is through desegregation, what's happening is the distribution of resources becomes more even. And so in the 70s, especially within districts, whether they were de facto or de jure segregated, the resources were disparate. And so white schools were much more well-resourced, broadly speaking.
Because we use property taxes, right, to pay for education.
Well, even within school districts than black, predominantly black schools. And so what busing did, what desegregation does, is it evens out the resources. And the scholarship, especially the recent research, is pretty conclusive. You know, there are some very important positive outcomes that occurred during the period of the 70s when busing was at its height for black students in the South, especially academic outcomes, lower dropout rates, higher graduation rates, but also outcomes that extend into career and life, health outcomes and higher salaries and the like. And so, again, this was about resources and not, as Biden seems to be suggesting, some kind of peer effect or sort of transmission from contact with white students.
Let me understand about the resources. So when you have more integrated schools, naturally that you have more, there's sort of more, you have more money in order to educate children?
I think when you have integrated schools, it's much more difficult for districts either intentionally or not to direct those resources to the white neighborhoods or to the wealthier neighborhoods. And that situation in the 70s is very different than the situation today. I think the resource disparity within a district is much less than it was in the 1970s. But I think that's really the mechanism by which desegregation worked in the 70s. Within districts, that those resources, the facilities, the quality teachers, student-teacher ratios, all sorts of human and financial resources were more evenly spread out. And so all students could access them equally rather than just white middle-class students.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of our guests. That's Rand Quinn. He's associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, he's the author of a forthcoming book called Class Action, Desegregation and Diversity in San Francisco Schools. Brett Gadsden joining us from the studios of Northwestern University, where he's a professor of history, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Between North and South, Delaware Desegregation and the Myth of American Sectionalism. He was telling us about growing up up in the Wilmington area being bused from the suburbs to a school in downtown Wilmington starting in the fourth grade. We want to hear from you what you think of desegregation busing, where it stands today. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. But there's a lot of, there has been over the last couple of decades, a lot of writing about busing, whether it worked, whether it didn't work, whether it was tried or whether it really wasn't tried. Where does busing stand today, and was it really tried in this country?
Well, I think there's a great irony about the Biden-Harris exchange that we all, that many of us, you know, witnessed the other day, is that busing has been, Biden and his past positions on busing has become this kind of hot topic in current campaign season. And for the most part, you know, no one's talking about busing, right? I think that it's kind of largely settled issue in many communities, i.e. we're not going to do it. The courts have turned their back on busing since the, you know, 1970s. For any politician, I think, to kind of announce school desegregation, or especially busing, as a kind of central part of their campaign platform would be very difficult. I think it would tantamount to a form of political suicide. And I think very few civil rights activists or educational reformers have, you know, have positioned school desegregation or busing at the center of their agendas. And so, you know, it's just this kind of odd moment in American political history. And unfortunately, Vice President Biden finds himself like right in the center of things.
Well, you wrote something in Politico that you see busing, this is to you, Brett, you see busing as really central to the civil rights movement.
Well, I think it is. I mean, you know, Joe Biden in the 1970s becomes, I argue, becomes emblematic of a kind of liberal backlash against civil rights. And I think there's a way that we need to kind of, when we try to think about the 70s, where, you know, that Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives are finding common cause in opposition to busing. There's not explicitly against Brown or the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but against, you know, forms of affirmative action that were designed to advance forms of housing integration, forms of school integration in the post, you know, Jim Crow era. And I think it's really interesting, and I think there's a lot more work to be done about this, about a new consensus that emerges in modern American political culture, where there's very, very little, you know, interest or sympathy among many Americans, particularly white Americans, in addressing the vestiges of Jim Crow or new forms of segregation that still persist in our nation.
Let me get Greg from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Greg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I think this is a very helpful conversation. It's one that Wilmington's been addressing for the past 40 years, sometimes better than others. And I think your comment by your guest about housing is integral to the challenges that we face in integrating our schools. But there's also some local activists of color that share Biden's point of view that busing failed, and that was Bebe Coaker. She's one of the most prominent African-American leaders when it comes to dealing with education reform in the state of Delaware for the past four decades. And she has just recently quoted in the News Journal saying as such. Our local editorial op-ed engagement editor, Matthew Albright, had a great line where he said, if Biden is to blame, all of Delaware is to blame. And that was a very, very poignant comment on his part, and it's also very true. So I think while, you know, Biden's comments taken out of context or in context in the 1970s can be a hot-button issue, when it comes to the complexities of redlining for decades and the various efforts to address the segregation of Delaware schools, now resegregated. They were resegregated. We had a Wilmington Education Improvement Commission that did an exhaustive survey, and its reforms failed by two votes in the state capitol 3 years ago. But just recently, signs of hope, Governor Carney signed a legislation to spend $15 million more in the schools to deal with behavioral health challenges, PTSD, because a lot of the children going to Wilmington schools that are being bused have a lot of emotional trauma that they're dealing with.
Greg, let me, only because I do want to give Brett, I see from my computer here, you were part of the first class to be bused into schools in Wilmington. So you and Brett share at least that particular experience. Greg, let me just, first of all, thanks for calling in, and let me give Brett a chance to respond, and we're about a minute away from our second break here. Go ahead, Brett.
Ms. Coker has been a very, she's an important figure in America, in Delaware history, and by extension, American history. And I think she articulates a lot of the frustrations that African Americans have had with school desegregation in America. But I think it's important to kind of frame this opposition historically, that African Americans have expressed their opposition to desegregation in anticipation of and in response to the inequitable implementation of school desegregation remedies and recurrent white backlash. And so I take Greg's point, and I think it's really important, but I think we have to be careful about how we position African Americans in the history of racial segregation. They're not the engines of racial segregation. They're not out forefront kind of doing that work. I think what many African American activists understand very well is that, you know, that white backlash is a real thing in this history, and it produces all kinds of forms of inequity. And what they're trying to do is preserving, is to carve out a space for, you know, more equitable and equal educational opportunities for black students.
We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation with Brett Gadsden and with Rand Quinn and with you. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and today on the show we're talking about some of the lessons of desegregation busing, talking with Rand Quinn, associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at Penn, author of a forthcoming book called Class Action, looking at the San Francisco schools and looking at the issue of desegregation and diversity. Brett Gadsden, again, joining us from the studios of Northwestern University. He's a professor of history at Northwestern, author of a book that came out a few years ago, Between North and South, Delaware, Desegregation and the Myth of American Sectionalism. And he grew up in the Wilmington area, was bused from the suburbs into downtown Wilmington when he was in fourth grade. Let me play one more clip. And this is from ABC's This Week, this past Sunday, George Stephanopoulos asking Senator Bernie Sanders about whether he supports busing.
Busing is certainly an option that is necessary in certain cases, but it is not the optimal. Does anybody think it's a good idea to put a kid on a bus, travel an hour to another school, into another neighborhood that he or she doesn't know? That's not the optimal. What is the optimal is to have great community schools which are integrated. That's what I think most people want to see. That's what I want to see.
Let me go back to you, Rand, and I want to pick up on something you said earlier in the hour about and looking at a state like California or looking at a city like San Francisco, racially different from Philadelphia, where we are here talking. That gives busing a different kind of a look.
Certainly in the 70s, but cities more and more in 2019 are looking like San Francisco did in the 1970s. And early on, busing in San Francisco was about creating a system that there's this notion of racial balance. And so the idea was that every school in the city should have the same proportion of black and white students as citywide. And so every school had some proportion of black or white students. Mm-hmm. And in the 70s, this worked out fine because black and white students were the largest subgroups in San Francisco. But by the late 70s, early 80s, Chinese American students and Latino students overtook in terms of a proportion of the school district, black and white students. And so the pivot that the district made was rather than this racial balance where every school had must have black and white students, they said, well, now integration for us, desegregation for us means that every school student student body must have some representation from multiple racial and ethnic groups. The district identified nine racial and ethnic groups, and schools had to have four of them at least, and no one racial ethnic group could be a majority. And so what that meant was that there could be...
That's a complicated formula.
It's a complicated formula, and what it meant was that there could be schools with no white students or no black students and would still conform to the desegregation order. But even this eventually became controversial, and part of it is due to the trajectory of desegregation jurisprudence and the use of racial classifications and proving de facto segregation. And so that, you know, these struggles, these desegregation busing struggles, are often decades upon decades upon decades. Right. And in that time, the law changes, the demographics change, the local context changes, and so these are what communities have to wrestle with.
I mean, is it? I guess it's about all these things. It's about race. It's about class. It's about ethnicity, right?
And housing patterns and residential discrimination and everything. It's something that really requires a systemic view.
Let me go back to you, Brad. And interesting in the. This is the Democratic Party's platform in 1976. Mandatory transportation of students beyond their neighborhoods for the purpose of desegregation remains a judicial tool of the last resort for the purpose of achieving school desegregation. So while Joe Biden's being, you know, called out by Kamala Harris, when you go back to the 70s, in many ways he seems like he was representing where the Democratic Party stood at that time.
Absolutely. I think Joe Biden was... and has always been a kind of mainstream Democrat. His politics are emblematic of, you know, core Democratic Party politics, you know, from the 70s on today. But I think, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting when we think about busing, there's this great survey by the Harris Survey that was conducted in October 1975, in which the surveyors found that, you know, many Americans didn't oppose busing. They opposed busing as a means of advancing racial balance in schools. Hmm. And that's an important distinction that needs to be made. That in many communities, the bus is the only way for students can get to class. And that we, across time and space, we've often transported our bus students considerable distances to give them access to the public schools in their communities. It's in the 1970s that we see a rising tide of opposition to busing to advance school desegregation. And I think it's that particular problem that promoted the civil rights icon Julian Bond to conclude, it's not the bus, it's us.
Oh.
And so even Senator Sanders is kind of gets it a little bit wrong there. And I think we still need to kind of ground our analysis always in an appreciation of the racial and the class nuances of this history.
But even going back, and Rand, we're again in Philadelphia struggling with a high poverty rate and also struggling with improving its schools, something that superintendents over time have worked to do. But picking up on this notion about community schools, this idea that let's make the neighborhood school the school that we want our children to go to. Is there something wrong about that?
It's nuanced. I think there is absolutely nothing wrong with figuring out ways to provide increased resources and improve the quality of schools in the most under-resourced schools in the city. And this notion of community schools and having schools become a hub for neighborhoods in the southwest or west portions of the city, these are all good things. I think... if that's in replacement of efforts to provide integrated school communities, I think that's cause for pause, and it's something that we as Philadelphians need to struggle with and wrestle with.
It's the idea, I guess, of separate and equal, right? I mean,
it's giving up on that vision of integration and accepting this notion of separate and equal.
Yeah. Let me read a couple of comments, and we've got some callers that want to join us as well. A comment from Desmond. He says, I was a substitute teacher in Newark, Delaware during the era of busing. Teachers had a really hard time adjusting to the integrated schools. An email from Tim, in discussing the success of busing in Delaware, I wonder what your guests would say about the evolution of charter and vo-tech schools in Wilmington and the surrounding communities. If I can toss those to you, Brad, and even just this notion about, it's interesting to have a teacher's perspective, feeling as if teachers really didn't, perhaps, weren't able to integrate this notion of busing as well as they could have or should have.
Those are great questions. I think that there's a lot more work to be done on the history of teachers and at the intersection of school desegregation, because they were the ones who had to, they were on the front lines and trying to figure out how to, manage their classrooms and their school populations through these really difficult times. To the extent to which, teachers face challenges, I think it was in my research, and I don't really – that's not the focus of my work, but I think a lot of it had to do with attempting to address the legacy of the educational gaps that they found now between their African American and white students, and the kind of tensions that those caused in their classrooms. I think a history of teachers reveals too the back to B.B. Coker's concerns. The inequitable and implementation of school desegregations, the ways in which Black students often found themselves kind of tracked into the kind of lower academic tracks and in newly desegregated school districts. As far as the problem of charter schools, I'm not as familiar with this history, but I don't think that they've represented a kind of solution to the problem of racial segregation today. I think that, the charter schools that we see and that get the most attention are operated as kind of fundamentally segregated institutions.
You've looked at charter schools. Let me toss that to you, Rand, and then we'll get some callers back in on the conversation.
Yes, it seems like choice and market-based reforms in education has really been what's replaced efforts to desegregate. And so the idea is that equal educational opportunity, so the logic goes, can be brought about by providing parents a choice. And there's a particular logic to that. It makes sense. Middle-class families can select. They can choose the schools that they that their kids enter because of their ability to the wider housing market that they have access to, and poor families don't have that choice. The scholarship on charter schools is pretty underwhelming. Scholarship on charter schools as a whole, and they do no better than district-run public schools. The quality of schools is no better. You have some really great, exciting, innovative charter schools in Philadelphia and elsewhere, and you also have charter schools that are underperforming. And as Brett mentioned, it doesn't solve the segregation. And so in these choice-based systems, at best, the segregation remains stagnant, and at worst, it's exacerbated by the introduction of these particular reforms built on choice.
So, in certain ways, the charter schools then sort of mirroring the public schools, in that you've got really good schools at some end, a lot probably in the middle, and then some very clearly struggling.
That's schools. Right. When we look at charter schools as a whole, there's a particular subset of charter schools that adopt a no-excuses model of reform that have been shown to produce achievement effects on standardized tests. But it's a complicated, nuanced issue, and certainly not a silver bullet in terms of the problem of reform.
Let me get Amy from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Amy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, so I'm based in Wilmington, Delaware, and I know you guys are talking about Biden and busing, but the inequity that has produced currently is in the city of Wilmington, specifically the Christina District. I've witnessed that the schools are just completely segregated, under-resourced. There's a 17% at level literacy rate for third and fourth graders, and I've kind of witnessed how that happens. And my question is, what do your guests think are actions that you can take now, sort of next steps to to just address the implementation of the resources that we do have to raise the level for the kids that are there now. Because, you know, I've kind of gone deep into trying to figure that out.
And, sure.
And I haven't found a solution.
And you're not alone in that, Amy. And actually, only because you're from the School of Education at Penn, I'm going to give you a chance, Rand, to respond to that.
Well, following the wave of desegregation, another set of reforms that occurred was around school finance reform. And so statewide efforts to provide a more equitable distribution of resources to local school districts. And I think that's something that continues to this day and is a way that we can solve some of the inequities in schools. Alongside the issue of the equitable distribution of resources is ensuring that there's an adequate amount of resources for schools to meet their performance standards. And so I think this is an important area of work for education advocates and activists and policymakers, is to really get states to provide a more equitable and adequate distribution of resources to the schools. Resources do matter, and this is one way that we can provide and create the schools that we want and hope for our young people.
Money matters. Let me read. Unfortunately, we've got callers. I'm just going to read what they have to say. Coral from New Jersey says, I agree with Biden's comments. I'm a product of busing. I don't think it failed, but that it was a beginning approach. The bigger strategy should have been to improve the neighborhood schools. There's more that needs to be done there. Ray from Philadelphia, went to a 95% white elementary school, but a predominantly black middle school. I was lucky because I was white, so I had the resources to get better opportunities. But my black peers who were equally as smart did not. Sean from Wayne says, are schools that are trying to desegregate today looking to these historic examples for insight? And I guess I'll give you, Brett, the last chance. Here we are talking about busing, something that you participated as a young boy in Wilmington, Delaware. Do you think it's back, or do you think it's a side issue? Is it where do you see this issue going? Big question here.
Yeah, what, 2 minutes or something?
Yeah, something like that.
I think it'll be interesting to see how Vice President Biden weathers this storm. And I think that, in how he weathers this storm, you know, might be some indication of the kind of relative position of school desegregation and various remedies like busing in our collective educational future. I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to, you know, recognize or realize a kind of collective pivot in our understanding about the role that busing plays in a kind of larger suite of options that we have to reform our nation's schools and address decades-long, centuries-long education gaps. But we'll just have to see.
Rand, go ahead. You were looking at me saying...
I think one thing is it's been interesting to see this issue come back into the public sphere. And we have superintendents who have pledged to address school segregation. You have the work of Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times and other people. And so it's interesting to see this conversation return.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining or having this conversation with us on Radio Times. Brett Gadsden, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Rand Quinn, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.